Today my topic is about bonding and rejecting in Arizona. I've been experiencing life in Arizona. Life in Arizona is just like life everywhere else, except when you're an outsider, like I am, coming from Florida to Arizona, sometimes it's easier to see characteristics in this new environment. Kind of like easy to see eccentricities or odd behavior or even negative behavior in somebody else. It's easier than seeing it in ourselves. So some things are very noticeable to me. And when you recognize that Arizona right now is a state in the news, on TV and newspapers and on the internet, as the front line in the offensive against illegal immigrants recently, and also having to do with a sheriff in recent years who has a particular passion for imprisonment and treatment of prisoners, Arizona is seen as being on the leading edge of this offensive line. I think that illegal immigration and justice and law and order are all very complex subjects. They would be impossible for a thorough explanation or exploration in a short talk like this. They would actually be impossible to address even in a long talk, because for most people, their current mindsets are so established based upon their experiences that those mindsets would resist any kind of inputs or information that is contrary to that. It just wouldn't penetrate. I think this is one of the typical human characteristic of all of us, this degree of closed-mindedness to another viewpoint after we've established our own mindsets. It's pretty well known that if you were to engage in a conversation about politics with somebody else, that neither you nor that other person is going to change your mind about politics. Your mindset is pretty solidly established. And apparently there's something so inherently important to a human identity or our existence that choosing a political point of view, makes us exist, it makes us feel stronger, makes us feel safer or something, but the idea of changing our political point of view is very difficult, if not impossible. And frankly, what's surprising to me is the amount of animosity that a political discussion, if you get into a conversation with somebody with differing points of view, it is amazing what level of hostility can erupt from that, not only in the other person, but in myself. And I don't know exactly why it is so important to hold on to these particular beliefs, this mindset. The reason I'm in Arizona is directly due to the concept of bonding. I have two friends from my time in the Army from about 40 years ago, and we're getting together this weekend in Sedona, and we have periodically over those 40 years rendezvoused in various places, either all three of us or any two of us. In 1969, it was March or April, me and my friends were assigned to be in the same room in the Army. And the reason we were is because alphabetically our names were similar. All of our last names began with the letter C. One of us was C.A., I was C.O., and the third person's name began with C.U. And one of us, Sal Carlomagno, C.A., is very social. He is the bonding force in our friendship. Literally, we've maintained this relationship since 1969, largely due to Sal's bonding energy. He is the one that's willing to reach out, thinks nothing of it, thinks it's fun, thinks it's good, and to bond with myself and our third friend, Kevin. And Sal does this, and because of his energy, urging us to get together in various places, is the reason we're here in Sedona. His purpose, his passion for a get-together moved me to commit to it. And once I committed to it, then it was two of us convincing Kevin to come to Sedona to bond. Over those years, Sal has led us to bond in Manhattan, where I lived, Albany, New York, where he lived, Columbus, Ohio, where Kevin lived, and we've met in Florida and Albany and Columbus over that time. So this bonding impulse that Sal was the real initiator to, after the Army, of course, with its belief in the alphabet, Sal has done it. In other words, Sal is very bonding-oriented with people, with things, with activities, with physical activities, with a lot of different things. And it's amazing to watch him in action or to listen to him describe situations. He talks about bonding. He doesn't use those words, but you can hear his affinity. You can hear his appreciation. You can hear his positive passion for lots of different things, designing and building homes over the years, to hunting and fishing, to hiking, to landscaping his home here, scuba diving, going on shark watching expeditions, and on and on and on and on. When he talks, he is basically talking from a point of view of bonding, because he appreciates and likes a lot of these different things. He spends very little of his time rejecting. Looking back over the 40 years that I've known Sal, I can say that he has never invested much of his energy into rejection. He doesn't spend much time, if any, being against things. He spends a lot of his time being for things. And it is, I think, directly related to him being happy with his life. And it shows. He looks good, he's healthy, physically fit, he's always eager, upbeat, because he's not at war with what is. He's not rejecting anything. In Arizona, and the only reason I'm mentioning Arizona is because this is where I happen to be standing, but in fact you could be any place on the planet, any state in the United States, any country in the world, and you see lots of emphasis is put on us against them. Us against them. With two groups of them down here, it's very obvious. This is the clearest problem. Them are illegal immigrants, and them are Native Americans on reservations or coming off the reservations. There's a lot of hostility toward those two groups. There's a lot of rejection of those two groups here and pretty much in a lot of states in America. It's interesting when you think of that sentence, them, those are the bad guys, illegal immigrants and Native Americans. It seems so funny as I was writing that the other day, that thought that, just a second here, Native Americans were the first people. Everybody else is an immigrant. It wasn't illegal because there were no laws set in place, but everybody else was an immigrant. And you can imagine from the standpoint of Native Americans, everybody else is a illegal immigrant. So I'll say white Anglos invaded a land, destroyed the native civilizations, displaced the surviving Native Americans to reservations in some of the lowest quality land available, totally barren in every way, agriculturally, spiritually, you name it. And that's where they got stuck on those things. And now we despise those Native Americans for not being more like us. Well, on the other hand, we're despising the illegal immigrants. And right now in this part of the world, we think in terms of Mexicans and other Hispanics from Central and South America. While obviously they're coming from Asia and other places too. So it's not such a big deal. When you really look at this movement of people migrating due to their self-interest, it's the same reason my ancestors and your ancestors came to the New World, self-interest. Their self-interest was not going to be satisfied or protected in their European or Asian, or in the case of Hispanics now in this century, in Mexico or Latin America. Their self-interest is not going to be met. So what do you do when your self-interest is not going to be met? You go to a place where there's more opportunity to meet your self-interest. That's a human thing. I think it's exactly the same with a one-celled animal. It is going to move in the direction of its self-interest. And to think it can be any other way is, I think, to be delusional. It's like, oh, look, water is running downhill. Oh, let's make a law against that. That's a natural physical force that is not going to be stopped by a law. You may put a dam in place, and obviously that's what people are trying to do, is put a border around the United States like a dam to prevent this natural flow of people seeking to migrate for opportunity to satisfy their own self-interest. Meanwhile, the people that want to erect the walls, the fences, and all these laws are doing it for their self-interest. Very interesting to me how this stuff all works. In a case like this, with the two versions of them, the Native Americans and the illegal immigrants, we reject those. We reject those people that we've destroyed because they are not like us after we fed them alcohol and displaced them and disadvantaged them in every way possible. And then we reject those who would intrude on our opportunities, wanting those same opportunities for themselves and their families. Since I've been here, I have heard hatred and disgust in the rejection of these two groups. It's as if this hatred is being directed at two groups that are monolithic, like Native Americans. There's only one type of Native American, just like there's only one type of illegal immigrant. That doesn't make any sense. That doesn't make any sense. That's like saying there's only one type of white person. There's only one type of black person. There's only one type of Japanese person or British person. That clearly is not true. But we lump everybody together when we start to categorize them in these two groups of them, illegal immigrants and Native Americans. And when these people are all described as bad or worthless or a drain on the economy or having no value, it's weird. We would never, as white people, conclude that all white people are bad just because Jeffrey Dahmer was a murderer. He was a white man. He acted the way he did. That doesn't mean all white men act the way Jeffrey Dahmer acted. We would say that he was an aberration created by his early experiences, even though I don't know what those were, and I don't know anything about him other than he was a murderer. But we certainly wouldn't interpret his behavior as representative of our entire white race. Over the years, politicians got a lot of value, and they're still doing it, from painting the face of black people and the welfare system, for instance, using images that are easy to demonize. I don't know if you can remember back to the hatred that was engendered for the welfare mother. And this was a mother that was driving around in a brand new Cadillac because of government welfare checks for having a lot of children that she didn't necessarily want, but because it brought money, extra welfare payments. This is it. How many of those welfare mothers existed? I have no idea, but I can guarantee this. It was mighty, mighty small, but it's a very handy soundbite. It's a very handy image to peddle to people who go into fear and anger at that, quote, injustice, and then for them to be all riled up and then mobilized to vote one way or another. Politicians have been doing that for long, long times. And when we really look at where all our money is going, welfare mothers are the least of our problems. Welfare politicians, that is, those people that are serving their own welfare at our expense, or much bigger financial drain, human rights drain, and all kinds of other disadvantages to the general population as they satisfy their self-interest at our expense. The rejections that I've heard over this weekend belong to really what I would consider to be solid mindsets. I think we all have mindsets, and that's not a bad thing. That's a good thing. It's a necessary thing. But to have one that is rock hard, that doesn't allow for movement or flexibility or the introduction of new energy, is like that really sets us up for a lot of struggle, a lot of pain. It would be like a teenager saying they've learned absolutely everything there is to learn. There's no need to learn anything else. No new information has any value to them. And what they're going to do is hold on to that viewpoint that they've formed up to the point of teenagehood, and that's it, and not change it from that point on. We would think, wow, that is really strange, dangerous, self-limiting. It's going to be tremendously provoking of unhappiness and struggle in that person's life. But over this weekend, these solid mindsets have not shown any degree of openness to consider how these two conditions came to be. The Native Americans that are not able to function in our society the way we expect us to function in our society. Secondarily, we haven't spent any time trying to understand this natural movement of people activated by their self-interest moving toward opportunity. It's always been that way. It'll always be this way. But nobody is trying to understand it. They think, well, if we put up fences high enough and thick enough, we'll be able to prevent this movement. But what about the cause? What about the cause? Do we look at that? We have to. We have to move in the direction of our self-interest. And it's in our self-interest to understand the cause. And if there's a way to affect the cause of these natural movements, then we can invest in that. It's for our self-interest and the self-interest of immigrants or people who otherwise would be immigrants, and it will be valuable for the Native Americans. I have come to this conclusion. Self-interest is life. If a person won't grow or think or move in the direction of their own self-interest, they're essentially choosing to die. Now, one of the complications is we're not taught as children about our self-interest, how important it is to our fulfillment of our potential. That's not described to us. We're basically told that when we think of ourselves a little bit or a lot, that's selfish, and that's a really, really bad thing. We should think of other people's self-interest. But the trouble is, when we think of somebody else's self-interest, and that other person or people don't think of our self-interest, it's, wait a minute, let me see if I can understand this. So five people think of one person's self-interest, and those people have nobody thinking of their self-interest. Let me think. Ooh, that sounds like the feudal system. That sounds like slavery. It's really an unworkable process. For us to sit here in the United States, the land of opportunity, and to think that and expect that people are not going to move to opportunity is absolutely crazy. Our whole history is geared to move toward opportunity. The expansion, well, first of all, obviously the pilgrims and all other early people that came to the United States, or back then to America, and then the movement westward, have always been based upon more opportunity. Horace Greeley, go west, young man, go west. Why? Why? Because that's where the opportunity was. That's why. That's how it was perceived. We did it in this life. Our parents, our grandparents, all of our ancestors did it as well as they could. we're the people, thanks to them, that are enjoying the opportunity that we're enjoying because they moved. They were immigrants early on. And I'd say all immigrants, basically people who voluntarily moved to a new place, did so because of self-interest. Now, it's a different story if you were African and somebody said you're going to the New World and you're doing it in the bottom of a slave ship. There's not much volunteering going on there. That's a different context entirely. But those that said, you know what, life in this country is lousy, I have to go to the New World. I heard it's got opportunity. Very few people, if anybody, no sane person, is going from a land of opportunity into a land of hostility or a one where the opportunity is less, where they're going to be, you know, harmed or be disadvantaged. Now, you could say, well, how do people get talked into going to war, to sacrifice their life for wars, for oil and whatever else is added to the packaging of a particular war? Patriotism, that kind of high value, doing it for the good of the country, that all those things that are painted to people who get them to volunteer to think this is a good idea. But because they're not willing to look deeper, they just hear the words that are put on to this. There are weapons of mass destruction. You've got to go to war, and it's in our self-interest as a country, and it's in your self-interest to be the one to risk your life and give your life for this. And when they look underneath it, they go, there were no weapons of mass destruction, but there's plenty of oil. There's plenty of oil there. If we were to look at this movement of immigrants and other things with other people, if we don't want that natural, unstoppable flow of humanity driven by self-interest into the U.S., what we better do is take a look at the opportunity that doesn't exist but could exist in their homelands. If we were to look at Mexico or Latin America and seeing how unstable and how unlevel the playing field is, we'd go, well, no kidding, they can't. There's no opportunity there. The economy is not set up for the distribution like it is in the United States. They don't have the communications. They don't have the road system. They don't have this and that. All of those really represent opportunities to create jobs and to create opportunity for people to build lives right in their birthplaces instead of having to migrate to someplace more benevolent, more receptive, or not receptive, hello, but rather more accessible of opportunity. It doesn't happen in these countries like it doesn't happen in the United States and in specific segments. It's not there. You know why? Because the self-interest of a few, the powerful, the politicians, the influential, can control opportunity. And the self-interest of the few overshadows the self-interest of the many. And the playing field can be kept on level. Now, you can recognize that the cheap, impoverished labor in a lot of countries, like China and some of the Asian countries, including Mexico, is good for the production of goods, and now those goods can be sold in the United States to us. We buy them, and we as the consumers, we don't want to know what's going on. We don't want to know the work conditions of those people in those foreign countries that or the way they're treated or how much they're paid or what their lifestyles are like. All we want is the products and services that come to us as a result of their production. If we were to see what was underneath all that, we would reject it. We would not accept those working conditions as being legitimate. I noticed in Arizona, and I think this is inevitable, that investing in rejection is our downfall. And it's our downfall for multiple reasons, one of which is, as we sow rejection, we're going to harvest rejection. It's inevitable. So as individuals, as we practice rejection, we can pretty much expect more of it to come into our experience. That law of cause and effect is inviolate. It's going to happen every single time. And as we sow rejection, we can, you know, you can really feel it. You can feel a fire of anger basically immediately. And it's certainly easy to see and hear in other people. I would suggest this. If you listen to yourself during the week and you listen to other people and you watch and you listen to the conversation, and if you divide it into two categories, bonding and rejecting, you'll start to become more aware of the way we think and the way we feel and the way other people and what's happening and what's being presented to us. I think it's physically noticeable in the countenances of people. Watch their face when they are describing something with which they're bonding. You go, that's a different face. Then find somebody and watch their face as they're describing something that they're rejecting. One is more beautiful and one is less beautiful. The idea that we refuse when we are rejecting, we are refusing to offer high vibration energy. That is, for instance, compassion or respect or generosity or acceptance or love or kindness and so on. We're literally refusing to offer those energies to the objects of our attention. And instead, we're offering the opposite to the objects of our scorn. We plant scorn, we're going to reap scorn. That is not what we want to do. And so by refusing to transmit high vibration energy, we're refusing to allow high vibration energy to enter our bodies, our minds, or our hearts. And we're damaging ourselves by choosing to offer and to operate from this place of lower awareness. When we're in a place of lower awareness, we're less effective at processing information. We're literally choosing to be like a caveman or a cavewoman. And then we're surprised, I'm not able to process information from my environment, the signals, stuff I see or hear or feel or sense. Nope. And in that lower awareness, survival instincts take over, and we start perceiving more things as being threatening. And I think that's what's going on in a lot of states in the country, to include Arizona, is this is threatening, this is threatening, this is threatening. And people are beating the drum telling us what is threatening. Listen to news and you'll know tsunamis are threatening, global warming is threatening, terrorists are threatening, Muslims are threatening, immigrants are threatening, the economy is being threatened, debt is threatening, unions are threatening, the corporate bigwigs are threatening, and on and on and on and on, all designed to drive us into lower awareness where we're much easier to manipulate. When we're in this lower state of awareness, though, we experience more fear, more stress. And when we get our mental or emotional or our physical options reduced down to the fundamental two, fight or flight, we have basically been reduced down to an animalistic set of activities. Overall, this habit of finding fault, hating, rejecting, sets in motion the process that's going to produce unhappiness for us as individuals, illness, struggle, and pain in a variety of areas in our lives. Our potential for happiness is going to be reduced because this high vibration energy flow that's available to us, we're declining it, we're denying it, we're reducing it because we've chosen to offer a lower vibration. We're accessing a different stream, a vibrational stream that is not healthy for us, but we're choosing it nonetheless. And as a result, the health and the happiness that is a natural outcome, those are natural outcomes of high vibration energy flow, they're no longer available because we've declined them. My friend Sal loves to hike. So we were hiking in Coconino National Forest in Sedona. And he loves hiking. He loves the area. He loves discovering the signs of animals on the trails. He loves and appreciates the beauty of the mesas and the sunlight and the shadows and the shading. And he loves the rock formations and the variety of plant and animal life and the pure physical exercise value of hiking. And because he was having this experience, this was his energetic attitude of bonding with all of that that I just listed. Kevin and I had the same experience when we were hiking with him. His energy of bonding gave us a frame of reference. We didn't have a mindset specifically about hiking in Coconino National Forest, but you know, we have our mindsets about exercise, about hiking, about walking, about whatever. But it was his bonding energy that overflowed, and we ended up having a similar level of appreciation for everything that Sal was pointing out or we were noticing on our own. It was cool. It was cool. Because the hikes that I'm familiar with were military in nature. And the same is true of Sal and Kevin before that. But Sal, as an outdoorsman, has been able to transition from a military type of march to, in fact, this whole different experience. He gave us a new normal for the way to appreciate this. It was cool. It's cool. And I think that a person who is bonding is setting himself up as a role model that helps other people who want to aspire and are, in fact, looking for ways to achieve a higher vibration relationship with their environment, with people and things and situations, that it was very helpful to have somebody lead the way energetically, if you will. If we want to learn to be happy, I think, much like our experience the other day, we're going to want to choose teachers and companions who are bonding with the subject at hand. If they're passionate, positively passionate about that, that is a teacher well worth learning from. A bonding person is only willing to connect to the object of their attention using high vibration energy. This leads to feeling good. It's kind of like everything that we've ever heard about spirituality, using love. Put your attention on something and then love it. Flow love. Transmit love to it. On the other hand, a rejecting person is only willing to connect to the object of their attention using lower vibration energies, much like a cave person would use a club to hit that object of their attention in order to make themselves feel safe, because the object of their attention, if there's any differences at all, looks like a possible threat. And because of the inability to process information effectively, they treat it like it is a threat and club it. As we each individually become aware of our patterns toward rejection in its varying forms, and you can hear this, it's subtle and it's not so subtle, to include fault finding or criticism or outright expressions of hatred to annoyance to sarcasm and belittlement of others, we're going to notice it probably more easily in others first. But if we can see it in ourselves and we can see it in our others, we're going to be able to make this connection that there is a direct relationship between rejection and unhappiness. Those two go hand in hand. And there's a direct relationship between bonding and happiness. And when we recognize that those things are, there's a correlation, cause and effect relationship, then we're going to say, the cause of rejection in our life, the cost of rejection in our life is too much to pay. I had a mentor who once told me, and I believe this to be true, a person will change quickly and easily when the cost of their current behavior is more than they are willing to pay. And when we can come to terms and we can come to understand the cost of our current behavior of rejection, it is likely we're no longer going to be willing to pay that price or play that game. Bonding to other people, to things, to situations, is really just the act and the habit of looking for and receiving awareness that inside of that person, thing, or situation is God. There is a God within that other person, thing, situation. Bonding to ourselves, our bodies, our characteristics, past, present, and future, really can give us access to greater divine resources, because this energy flow that comes to us is going to be greater, not that it wasn't always available to us, but we're constricted, we're limited, we're closed down when we're in rejection, because that's basically a fight mode. We're at war. We're arguing with whatever condition we're talking about, and we have to go into self-protection. That's the nature of rejection. It's some sort of processing of threat and danger and risk, and we disadvantage ourselves from the energy flow that can come from divine consciousness to us and through us. As we access, through our bonding, divine consciousness, we're going to be able to create for happier lives, healthier lives, lives more filled with love and success. And the bonding that I think it's easiest and perhaps most important to start with is self-accepting. Self-accepting is a wonderful bonding habit to develop. And then from that place, we start to overflow to other people, to other things, to other situations, because we've recognized the God within us, and now all of a sudden our awareness of the God within other people and things is far greater. I would like to end this service with a prayer. And this is the pluralized version of the prayer from letter 8 of Christ Returns, Reveal Startling Truth. Father, Mother Life, you are our life, our constant support, our health, our protection, our perfect fulfillment of every need, and our highest inspiration. We ask you to reveal the true reality of yourself to us. We know that it is your will that we should be fully illumined, that we may better receive awareness of your presence within and around us. We believe and know that this is possible. We believe that you protect and maintain us within perfect love. We know that our eventual purpose is to express you. As we speak to you, we know you are perfectly receptive of us, for you are universal loving intelligence, which has so marvelously designed this world and brought it into visible form. We know that as we ask you to speak to us, we are sending out a consciousness searchlight into your divine consciousness, and as we listen to you, you will be penetrating our human consciousness and coming ever closer to our increasingly receptive minds and hearts. We commit ourselves and our lives into your care. Thank you. It is so. Amen.